Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Basement Couch. I'm your host, Garage Markey. I first heard my guest today when I was six, when their song Sent Around started my love of alternative rock with 15 albums since 1986.
You're making me feel like Peter Tork.
With 15 albums since 1986 and a 16th one on the way in March, this band has been hailed as one of the most foremost names in the alternative genre. It's my honor to introduce John Flansburgh of They Might Be Giants. How are you today, John? Hey, how are you?
Very excited to be here.
I'm excited too, man.
I feel like this is a very spontaneous meetup.
Yeah.
So that's crazy. I mean, I guess... you know, a lot of our audience is you know, college-age people and people in their 20s. And I never really think about when they got into the band. You know, it's completely plausible that, you know, there's tons of people who've just, you know, their relationship to They Might Be Giants is like my relationship to Burl Ives or something. It's like, oh, yeah, they're the guys who do that stuff. It's strange, but I guess it's good.
Well, I guess
it seems so unneurotic.
Yeah.
To be in a band that's just this venerable.
Yeah.
If that's the word, venerable maybe isn't the word. Old.
I guess my first question is then, like, because you do kind of you are kind of like an eclectic band for I guess people pick you up as they grow up. What do you think?
We like to say we're not for everybody.
What's
get off of my lawn.
What do you think is the appeal of They Might Be Giants for all age groups? Because you really have been hitting all age groups as of late.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing about, like, when you hear the expression, like, you know, good for all ages, it immediately makes you think it's, like, good for nobody. But, you know, obviously there's, like, kind of like a... some kind of, like... innocence or sweetness in some of the stuff we do, or at least the an allusion to it. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think we think of what we're doing as you know, kind of complicated. And you know, the truth is, we don't really. You know, some people write for their audience. Some people are very good at kind of thinking about how their stuff is going to land. For us, it's a bit more personal than that, and it's not because we feel like that's how you make better stuff. It's just like we're already kind of nervous and self-conscious and just kind of shutting out the world and doing stuff on our own terms is kind of the only way we can do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just saw this weird, really super long documentary about the Eagles.
Yeah.
It's not exactly, I mean, a band, in my teen years, they were a band that I really despised. But you know, it was. I don't really know much about the Eagles, but it was really clear that there was something very willful about their success. It wasn't like an act. It wasn't just like they were a bunch of like stoners tripping through the world who happened to blow up. Which you know, for some bands of that time, like in some ways, I feel like Fleetwood Mac really actually kind of was. I mean, maybe. One of the guys in Fleetwood Mac had like a vision of like a professional life, but it seems like they were kind of
just doing it for the hell of it.
Yeah, I mean they were just like rockers, you know, and they were just there. Uh-huh. But like the Eagles, they were I don't know, it was a real eye opener because they were just talking about like, you know, how to make hits and it was very odd to me. I mean, they just had a much better sense of their audience. I guess what I'm trying to say, without just like, you know, just turning this into an
Eagles documentary,
a slam on the Eagles, is just that it reminded me that there are lots of people in music who are thinking about their audience. You know, whether it's Chuck Berry or the Eagles or you know, U2 or whoever. You know, it's a way to have a career is to know your audience. And I mean, or it's one way to have a career. Mm-hmm. But it's such a recessive trait for us, you know. It's not something that we're good at. Mm.
In recent years, you and John Linnell have written three successful kids albums. Now that you're back to writing adult albums, do you feel like there's been a shift in the creative process, or do things kind of just stay the same and you just write not educational?
Well, you know, writing for the kids stuff was actually very sort of invigorating for us because it's such a kind of open-ended, trippy, way of working. You know, you're writing songs for people who don't have any sense of like music history. You know, they don't know what's the right or wrong way to do anything. You know,
yeah.
So because they're kids, and so it's. I think we kind of felt like it was an opportunity to do more unusual stuff, and mm-hmm. It was very joyful for us doing and liberating for us to do that work. But the kid stuff is kind of it's sort of an unusual, like, double-edged sword, because when you actually do kids' shows, mm-hmm. you know, there's really no more difficult audience. It's really, you know, it's really unrewarding playing for kids. You know, it is an honor to be part of kids' lives and have our songs be, you know, to find out that a kid hears our song when they're like, you know, 3 years old, and it's like the first song they ever liked. Mm-hmm. That to me is like, you know, it's a total mind blower, and it's completely awesome. But like, as just like a guy in a rock band on my own ego trip, like to go out and perform for a group of people who aren't even looking at me, mm-hmm. is you know, which is what a kid's audience is. It's a little bit tough, you know. I mean, my sympathies for public school teachers have grown exponentially over the years, because they've got the attention span. 3-year-olds have the attention span of 3-year-olds.
Mm. As a personal nerdy question, an aside to that, I know you guys are friends with Sarah Vowell, and I was wondering if you ever made a U.S. history album, would you ever consult her, like, on topics to focus on?
Well, you know, people, we've done words and numbers and science, mm-hmm. and it seems like the big one left would be history, but I think they'd probably bring back, like, the communist blacklist just for one day to make sure that we weren't heard. Mm. You know, I'm a knee-jerk liberal from Boston, and my vision of history is straight out of, like, you know, the people's history. Mm. So I don't think anybody wants to hear my pinko prattle.
Yeah. Okay. So as a band that had,
all I can say is raise the minimum wage.
Yeah.
and go union.
Yeah. As a band that has a lot of reoccurring themes, I feel you guys get all, like, unfairly pigeonholed as those two nerdy guys from Brooklyn when you really,
well, I mean, we probably are, you know, kind of nerdy by, you know,
definition,
jock standard.
Yeah.
But we're not. You know, who cares?
Yeah, I, that's what I was getting at. But, like, I just feel you guys are super versatile in both sound and lyrics. Have you ever get discouraged by a review you've read that said, like, oh, these guys are kind of doing the same thing over and over again, like, shun them, you know?
Well, I mean, we are kind of doing the same thing over and over again, I guess. You know, there's plenty of reasons to be discouraged when you're a musician. I mean, it's a pretty crummy way to live your life. But we're used to it, and I think, you know, we kind of went into it with pretty realistic expectations. We weren't teenagers when we started, so we didn't have, like, big fantasies about what was possible. And we knew, I think we were pretty realistic that if we were going to do something that was really vivid and important to us, it might not be that universal. And I think popularity is, you know, is a kind of a trap that, you know, trying to appeal to a really broad group of people, unless you're coming at it with a really unique sense of, you know, really a really extreme sensibility and have a tremendous amount of charisma and talent, it's really you're kind of probably making a mistake just trying to ride the pop thing. I mean, there are, you know, there are exceptions, of course. I mean, people like, you know, David Bowie or Prince or something. People can pull it off, but, you know, they're very rare. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we're just happy to be kind of over on the left-hand side of things with our, you know, with our lumpy awkward selves.
Coming from personal experience, I've encountered many interesting fans of yours at shows and gatherings, what have you. I know your documentary shows some hardcore fans, but in, I guess, more recent years, like maybe say the last 5 years, what was the most memorable fan you've encountered? Like, how hardcore have they been?
Well, you know, the one thing about the movie that made me a little sad is that the very day that that those interviews with those fans, all the people in the movie are interviewed at like some Long Island record store, mm-hmm. and you know, there's definitely like some real like front row types that are that the filmmakers talk to, but the person that they missed was the most fascinating to me, and not atypical of some of our earliest fans when Don't Let Start was getting played on WDRE on Long Island. We had this sort of, we really broke through in the way like a pop band breaks through with a song to the general population of Long Island. And it kind of gave us unique access to some people there that I don't think we really ever had anywhere else. But there was this guy in the parking lot who we met in the parking lot as we were coming up to the in-store, who was just your classic, you know, Strong Island, tough guy, you know, head-butting, like, tattooed, I'm going to steal your car kind of guy. And he was like, you guys are awesome! and it was, you know, it was very flattering. And it was, I mean, I think the farther away from, like, whatever cultural, you know, preconceived notion you have of your place, the person comes from, the more rewarding it is, it just seems like a bigger compliment. And and he was I really wanted to just like run in and pull him in front of the camera.
Oh, yeah, totally.
He was such a funny guy. But you know, a lot of times when I go into guitar shops, I'll meet people who really I'll meet musicians who felt kind of empowered by our path, and I'm not. You know, as I say, like, you know, I think, you know, it's being a musician is hard and complicated and it's not really, it's not really, something that, you know, people tend to do for their whole lives. It's just, it's such an unreasonable thing to do. But, you know, when I do go into music shops and people, I think, you know, we're kind of, for whatever reason, we're kind of held up as, you know, a bunch of, As people kind of did it their way, and I mean, I'm very aware of all of the multitude of compromises that we've been up against over the years. So I have a much more kind of street level feeling about, you know, what it is we're up against.
Yeah,
but. But it's I think, you know, if people look at us and think like, you know, yeah, you can kind of, you know, do your own thing and continue to and find a career and find an audience for what you're doing, and that if that makes people feel empowered, I think that's pretty cool.
Cool. I feel like one of the things you do though to stay in the public conscience, like with I guess in a more mainstream sense, is your work in film and television. Most notably, your song "Boss of Me," which was the theme to Malcolm in the Middle. How do you guys get these gigs, and do you actually end up liking any of the shows or films you've worked on?
Well, we worked on Malcolm in the Middle for a couple of years doing incidental music, and that was, you know, very much a job, and it actually turned into a really high pressure job. And I think if you asked anybody who worked on the show, they'd probably tell you that we did a really bad job.
Really?
Because just it was really hard to keep up with. We weren't living in Los Angeles. And because there was so much pressure from the network, because it was such a big hit, I think we were kind of behind the eight ball before we even started. The Malcolm show... I don't think we had very much perspective on it because we were just like, you know, kind of part of the beginning, the very beginnings of the show. I mean, in some ways, it's interesting, like the show Freaks and Geeks, which I think ultimately is probably like a more personal show to the right, by the writing.
Yeah.
Was not as nearly as big a success, and they both launched at the exact same time. And it, I mean, it sort of seemed like, you know, there's cycles in television, and a lot of times very similar shows launch at the exact same moment. You know, think, you know, The Addams Family and The Munsters, or, you know, Whitney and Two Broke Girls, and like, you know, Freaks and Geeks and Malcolm in the Middle both happened at the same moment. And, but what was interesting from our perspective is we were supplying all these music cues and watching the edit of that show. When we did the pilot, I think there were probably 10 music cues over the course of 23 minutes, which is like pretty, which is not a small number of cues. That was like a pretty musical show. But immediately once it went on the air, there would be 23, 25, sometimes 27 music cues per episode. There's basically continuous, because it didn't have a laugh track, they put in a continuous music through the edit of the show, and it really, the music was kind of the engine, or the just the, it created the energy of the edit, and it was, it really became the template for all these Fox shows afterwards. Like, it's the way one camera shows are done now. And I think in some ways, as good as Freaks and Geeks was, one place where it kind of fell down was it had a very kind of slow pace.
Yeah, yeah.
And it felt, and it really had a stillness to it that made it a little bit more awkward. And I think they probably did that for artistic reasons. It really suits the material. But ultimately, you know, it's strange to be on the other side of, you know, to be on a competitive program and see, and actually be supplying like the super, you know, freaky fuel that made the show kind of click. You know, the Malcolm show definitely was like designed to be a hit.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, in some ways, you know, it was really, really hard not to see it as like a live version of The Simpsons.
Yeah, totally.
Very often it seemed
absolutely
like that's what they were kind of going. But you know, The Simpsons was Malcolm replaced The Simpsons as the number one show on Fox. So, yeah. You know, it's all weird. But yeah, we've done a lot of television stuff over the years. You know, we did the Daily Show, and that's still going, which is kind of insane. And
a lot of kids shows. Mickey Mouse Clubhouse.
Yeah, we've done a bunch of kids shows, and we've done, I'm trying to think of like what the other, you know, we did a lot of theme things, a lot of television work in the aughts. We haven't really done much recently, but if there are any television executives listening to this show, we're ready to get back in the game.
I'm trying to do a web series, so maybe somewhere down the road when it's popular.
Yeah,
totally.
License some stuff. That's
sweet.
Even
sweet. We're going to go to a song from They Might Be Giants. It's off their newest album, Nanobots, released in 2013 on Idlewild Records. It's called Lost My Mind, and we'll be back with more from John Flansburgh of They Might Be Giants in just a second. And now we're back with John Flansburgh on the basement couch. So let's talk about your new upcoming album for just a little bit. It has 25 songs, which is a lot for a studio album, but on top of that, there's a short runtime. What was the idea behind that? It kind of reminds you of Elvis Costello's Get Happy, in a sense.
Well, that's a great record. It's not as uniform as Get Happy. This album's 45 minutes long, and there's 25 songs on it, but if you took out 10 of the songs, it would probably be 40 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
So, there are lots of full length songs on the album. There's a dozen or so super shorties. And the thing that's nice about the short songs, I think, is it kind of makes the experience of hearing the whole album really unpredictable, and just. I mean, maybe psychedelic isn't the best term, but there's something kaleidoscopic about not knowing how long anything's going to last. And I think that just kind of makes it a more interesting project.
Mm-hmm. So, despite the full band behind you guys, and it's been the way since it's been that way since John Henry. I feel like you guys have released a lot of the three songs you guys released on this album so far on the EP. Kind of harken back to the first four albums in that there's more intimate feel to them, like especially Black Ops. I could have totally seen that being on like Flood or Apollo 18.
Oh, interesting.
As far as sound goes, what was your guys' main inspiration for a lot of these songs?
Well, I think the past 5 years, the band discussions have revolved around like just a very small set of things, trying to figure out how to do things that are like idiomatic but don't feel like pastiche is really important. Like, you know, like there, you can, one of the things about working with live musicians is that you can get very, very close to just reproducing any kind of musical style. And when you do the kind of writing that we do, it's sort of tempting just to go all the way with that, in that kind of direction. And we've actually had conversations about how that, like, on, by and large, on Beatle albums, like especially early Beatle albums, even when they're doing like a country song or doing some other kind of identifiable stylistic departure from just their pop music, it still sounds like the Beatles. It still feels like the style of the combo is in place. Like, it doesn't sound like a imitation of another kind of music. And I think that that's something that we've kind of tried to hone in on a little bit more. There are a lot of arguments about how many drum fills should be in a song. That's like another hot topic within the band. It's like how sort of filigreed the rhythm section should be. We've done like on the new album, one of the tracks that's already come out is a song called Call You Mom. And when we were recording it, the original sort of version of it seemed very formal and kind of stiff. And as the session evolved, it just got it just seemed like the song needed more kind of a crazier vibe to it. It was sounding a little like just add water in the in a way.
So you needed a frantic pace, basically.
Well, now the final version of it has a really over the top quality. In fact, the intro of the song is actually an edit piece of the very last section of the song, a different take of the very last section of the song, sort of adhered to the beginning. So it basically starts at like this crescendo moment and then kind of plows into the regular form of the song. But it was something that we sort of struggled with. I guess the thing is, when we started, we were a duo working with drum machines.
And even
if we were just doing like a straight up rock song, it still came out the other end sounding pretty singular and pretty different than just like drums, bass, guitar, like whatever your kind of rock and roll preset version of a band is. It never sounded like that, no matter what we were doing. And there are advantages to that. You know, there are drawbacks, but they're also, you know, it's interesting to always be working with on something that sounds kind of fundamentally different. And the second we took on a band, all of a sudden, everything we're doing sounded kind of normal, and just trying to figure out how to arrange songs in ways that were as extreme as working with a drum machine was really a big challenge. And I think, I mean, not to be overly self-critical, I think it really took us the better part of 10 years to really figure out how to get it back to that level, that extreme level. Like, it just was something we didn't know how to do.
Yeah.
So.
Well, which is really weird, because I always considered, like, my two favorite albums are Apollo 18 and John Henry, which, like, it's really interesting that, like, you feel it took you that long to kind of, like, use the full band as, you know, transition to, like, the full band and get, like...
Well, you see, I have like, difficulties with John Henry. I find it a little samey. I mean, I guess maybe I feel I have I'm a guy and they might be giants, so I've got, like, I have a kind of musical ADD that, you might anticipate. But mm-hmm. Working on John Henry, I felt like there were a lot of mid-tempo songs, and I didn't feel like it had the kind of scope that I like in an album. So, it was a strange experience. We were working with a producer who really, I think, wanted to make, wanted to kind of dampen down the kookiness of the band.
And get you guys kind of like in a more like serious manner in a sense, or?
I think just calm things down more than, it wasn't so much that the songs had to be
serious.
Serious. It's just that they had to not be manic or like. I remember like there's a the song Meet James Ensor is on that album, mm-hmm. and Meet James Ensor, a lot of people like that song. It's like it's a very natural kind of song for They Might Be Giants and our audience, and he like filibustered to have that song not be included on the record.
Wow.
And and I just thought, this is a really strange conversation to be having, given who we are as a band and given how, Meet James Ensor is also a really up-tempo song. And when you're sequencing a record, especially a record that's really long, every up-tempo song you've got is kind of a welcome relief. It's like, energy. Mm. I hate to say this, but the next radio interview is coming in.
Since John does have a couple more interviews to get to, I think we're going to wrap it up here. John, thank you for joining me today.
Hey, I'd love to do this any other time. Maybe we can come into the station and play.
Oh my God, that would be amazing. Absolutely.
It would be amazing.
Yeah.
We live right in New York City. There's no reason we shouldn't.
Totally, yeah. I'm on Saturday nights at 9 o'clock, so if you guys ever want to stop by.
What's better than playing on the radio on Saturday night?
Definitely. Drop me an email. It'd be great.
All right, so, thank you so much, Gary.
No problem. If you'd like to find out more about They Might Be Giants, you can check out their website. They have a new album coming out, Nanobots, March 5th, and I'll see you guys next week.